Let us read in Ecclesiastes chapter 3 and verse 11. He hath made everything beautiful in his time. Also, he hath set the world in their heart, so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. In his book 1984, George Orwell wrote, "He that controls the past controls the future." He that controls the past controls the future. Now, of course, there he was speaking in terms of governments that try to rewrite history to their own advantage, to help them in future policies and plans. But there is a truth in what he said, even on an individual level. And that truth is brought before us here in this chapter. Our attitude to the past controls how we face the future. And at this time of the changing of the years, we tend to have this reflexive backwards, forwards look. And they're linked. And what we're taught here in this chapter is that the way we reflect on the past will determine how we face the future. And two responses are brought before us here as to how to look at the past, or say at 2008. There's the response of pessimistic fatalism, and there's the response of optimistic faith. We'd like to look at this passage under two headings. First of all, many human events. And secondly, one divine purpose. That's really summed up in the banner over this chapter. To everything there is a season and a time, to every purpose under the heaven. There you've got many human events, everything and every purpose. And there you've got the one divine purpose, a season and a time. Both these words mean appointed times or predetermined times. Let's look first of all at many human events. As you look back at 2008, no doubt we could all write a long list of many things that happened to us and our thoughts on it. But here we're supplied with a summary of, really, you might say, every possible human eventuality. I wonder if you can find yourself in this list. He begins in verse 2, a time to be born and a time to die. Well, that just sums up really everything, doesn't it? Birth and death, and then there's everything in between that now follows. There's a time to plant or sow and a time to pluck up or harvest. There's a time to kill, speaking of war, and a time to heal, time to build bridges and make peace treaties. There's a time to break down or demolish, and a time to build up, construct. A time to weep, and a time to laugh, a time to mourn, and a time to dance. A time to cast away stones, and a time to gather stones together. This refers to the what used to happen in ancient warfare, where armies would go into battle, and they'd be passing along roads to meet their foes. And one of the strategies used was that the roads would be strewn with stones and boulders and obstacles to make their way difficult. Or if an army was fleeing, They too would throw stones and obstacles behind them in order to make the pursuing army find it difficult to discover them. So here he's speaking of a time to advance in war, clearing away stones, and a time to retreat, time to put stones behind you. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to get or invest and gain, and a time to lose, to see our investments decrease. How many have seen that in the past year? There's a time to keep, a time to store things, and a time to cast away, a time to have a clear out. A time to rend, and a time to sow. This is speaking of the ancient practice of how clothes were made, garments were made for children, and then as they outgrew them, they were often ripped, and then more material was sewn into them to make the clothes last longer. A time to keep silence and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time of war and a time of peace. He's looking at the whole human experience. And he's saying there are just so many human events. So many unpredictables. So many variables. So many things that happen. So many events that we have no control over. We look back over 2008 and we see that there was, yes, a time for mourning and there was a time for laughing. There was a time for advancing and a time for retreating. There was a time to invest and then there was a time to suffer loss in investment. There was a time to grow and there was a time to suffer ill health. We look back and we see these various uncontrollable, unpredictable events in our lives. And for some of you, it was a very full 2008. Maybe you look at this and you say, just about all of these things happened to me in one way or another, or to my loved ones. Now look out on this changing, checkered, unpredictable life. I look back at 2008 and I see all these things, all these events. What a long list I've got. And what's your response to it? Is it simply that? Many human events? Well, there's somebody here who responds in that way. If you look at verse 9, as the list comes to an end, there's a response of pessimistic fatalism. What profit hath he that worketh in that wherein he laboureth? We've here had described for us 14 good events and 14 bad events. And in essence, this man's saying, if I take 14 good events and subtract from it 14 bad events, what do I have left but a big zero? Pointlessness. Meaninglessness. Emptiness. What profit? Is there anything left in the plus column when I subtract 14 negatives from 14 positives? Life's just this big, huge zero. And many people have looked back on 2008 and come to that conclusion. I've had all these good things, but I've had all these bad things. Just what's the point in it all? It was just like 2007 and 2006. Why am I getting up so early in the morning? Why am I working so late at night? Why am I working so hard to keep my family together? Why am I putting all this effort into making life worth living, if at the end of it all, that's just zero, nothingness, emptiness, and meaninglessness? Look at all I've worked at, all I've laboured for, all the effort, all the self-sacrifice, all the self-denial. What profit is there? Is that how you survey 2008? Is that how you view the past? This pessimistic fatalism, this sense of what's the point in it all? Many human events. We pass from one extreme to the other, then one extreme to the other, and one extreme to the other, and at the end of the day, I'm no further forward. I'm right back where I started. Have I got another year of this ahead? Can I sustain this once more? Can I keep this going? Can I keep up this face? Can I just keep doing this just because it's expected of me? How many think like that? More than we realize. Young people even. You might be here today and does this not strike a chord with you? It's just all about getting to buy the next thing and then that gets outdated and you buy the next toy and that gets outdated. It's all just about buying the next set of fashionable clothes only for them to pass out of fashion in a few months. All this studying and all this exam, is it all just to see what my parents do, which is work every hour of the night and day just to pay the bills? And then events in the economy transpire that just bring to nothing all my work and savings and labour. I mean, is it really worth it? What's the point? That's a question Solomon asks repeatedly throughout this book as he surveys life without God in it. As he surveys life in just a human perspective. As he surveys life, as he says, under the sun, with that perspective that's limited by the horizon of the sun, as he looks out on this earth. And surely if anyone would stop for long enough and consider life just from that perspective, you'd come to that conclusion. What is the point of it all? Even very clever men have come to this conclusion. Professor Joseph Wood Crutch of Columbia University wrote this. There is no reason to suppose that a man's life has any more meaning than the life of the humblest insect that crawls from one annihilation to another. Karl Marx even said, history repeats itself, first as a tragedy, then as a farce. And if that is the way you reflect on 2008, what kind of 2009 are you going to have? He who controls the past controls the future. If that's your view of the past, you're not going into 2009 with much hope, are you? Like this person here. Under the sun living. Living just on a human level. Just living on this horizontal level. You're going to come to this conclusion. And he says in verse 10, I've seen the travail which God hath given to the sons of men. He says, God has done this. God hasn't packed this world with experiences in order to make you satisfied here. Quite the reverse. He's brought in all these extremes, all these changeable events and unpredictable happenings for a purpose. It's to make you feel the travail. It's to make you feel the weariness of it. It's to make you look at the sweat and the blood and the tears. And it's to make you think. That's what he says here. I've seen the travail which God hath given to the sons of men to be exercised in it. He says, that's what he wants you to do. He wants you to look back at 08. He wants you to ponder it. He wants you to see the labour of it and the toil of it. He wants you to exercise your mind and think. Don't just have another 09 like 08 was and go on and on and on and on and on. He's saying, stop. Ponder what God has brought into your life. Think about what's happening. Who's been born and who's died. What you've invested in and what you've lost. What you've built. What you've demolished. What you've wept over. What you've mourned over. Think of all these things. But secondly, let's look at one divine purpose. If all you see is many human events, then you will have this response of pessimistic fatalism. But if you see beyond all these human events and behind them, one divine purpose, then your response will be one of optimistic faith. And this is what Solomon passes into here. As we said, there was this banner over this chapter, to everything there is a season, there is an appointed time. And a time to every purpose under the heaven. And then he expands on that in verses 11 to 15. I'd like to bring seven words that he summarizes his response with. Seven words to pass into 2009 with. You could take each word, one a day for the next 7 days till you're back in church again, and reflect on it and meditate on it. Because this is the response of somebody that sees one divine purpose. This is the response of optimistic faith. They look back at 08 and in the midst of all the dust and all the noise and all the chaos and all the many human events, he says, yes, one divine purpose. Notice the first word. It's beautiful. He has made, see, God is now introduced. He has made everything beautiful in his time. That's remarkable, isn't it? Everything is beautiful, Solomon says. You think that's just impossible to say. When I look back in 08, everything is beautiful. Well, the word beautiful here doesn't mean really what we are used to thinking of as beautiful, like an aesthetic beauty. Like you might look at a flower or a landscape and say beautiful. What it really means is fitting or harmonious or everything in its right place. You know, you might open a computer and you look inside it with amateur eyes and you think, this is a mess. This is chaos. This has just all been thrown in there. But you come with a professional eye and look at it, and that professional eye can see everything is beautiful. It just fits. It's all in the right place. It's all doing the right thing. It can see that that's there as it should be, and that's there as it should be, and that colour, and everything is just right. And this is what Solomon is saying as he looks back at his life with all its ups and downs and ins and outs and topsy-turvy, unpredictable, checkered, changeable events. From the human perspective, everything's a mess. But he has made everything beautiful in his time. He's saying, but God has put everything in its exact right place. Beautiful. He's not asking you to look at the most painful events in your life, to see a loved one suffer and die and say, you know, that event in and of itself is beautiful. It's not. It's what we see there is ugly and hideous and offensive and agony. But God has put that event in exactly the right place in your life and in his whole plan for his church and his world. Notice it doesn't say he's made everything beautiful in my time. No. He's not working to our timetable. He's not looking at our clocks. It's his purpose and it's his timetable. And as God looks at this, as he looks at this world, he doesn't see what we see. He doesn't see what we think to be just everything's a mess. And when we look at even our own individual lives, and we think this is just chaos, pointless, meaningless. No. God looks down and he says, everything is exactly as it should be in my great plan and purpose. That takes faith, doesn't it? That takes faith. Everything is beautiful in his time. The second word is eternity. He has made everything beautiful in his time. Also, he has set the world in their heart. Now, the Hebrew word behind world here is olam, which is translated everywhere else in our Bible as ages or eternity. This is the only place that our translators translated it world. And it's because that when they wrote our Bible, this was a phrase that was used. The world was used for the ages. The world was viewed as a term to describe the passing ages and centuries and millennia. But if we were to translate this today, we would put in the word that for us means the same, eternity. And that's what the word most commonly is translated. And what we're told here is that God has set eternity in our hearts. What does that mean? It means that although when you look at this world, it looks as if everyone's taken up with the 24-hour a day, 7 day a week, 365 days of the year calendar, although it looks as if all people think about is the next time, the next day, and the next week, and the next year, but actually, in every single human heart, there is a sense of eternity, and that God uses these varied, changing human events to impress in the human heart a sense of eternity and to kindle and to stimulate a sense of there's got to be something more than this. He's saying that's what 08 has done for many people. So we should be greatly encouraged when we go out to outreach and witness and evangelize. We're not talking to people and who all they have a sense of is second after second after second. No, God has put eternity in their hearts. They know deep down. They know. God's put it there, that knowledge. They know. The time is one day going to be no more. They know that there is life after death. They know there is eternity after time. And God brings all these events into human lives to stir up that sense. I'm heading to eternity. For the Christian, this is a great hope. When we look at this world and all the events, our lives and all the providences, this isn't the end. This isn't everything. There was, yes, it's pointless, but it's not. We're heading to an eternity, an everlastingness. Something far better than this. But, of course, if you're without hope of that, that knowledge can only worry you, convict you, make you afraid. And you know, don't you? You might say to your mum or dad or your friends, or to anyone who challenges you, well, you know, we can't be sure of that. Who knows, you know, has anyone ever come back and told us? Prove it to me. Give me scientific evidence. Yes, you might have all the arguments. You might know all the various things to say that unbelievers say to try and deflect the claims of Christ on your life. But you know deep down. Because God has put something deep down in you. You know there is an eternity. You know that this world is passing and so are you. And you know that you will exist for as long as eternity exists. That worries an unbeliever, and it should. God's put that there to stir you up to seek salvation in Christ, to seek safety for eternity. For the believer, he looks back over 08 and sees all the times and the events, but then he turns forward and he says, yes, but eternity. The sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall yet be revealed. But then, third word here is humility. He has set eternity in their heart so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. If this is all there is, if time, chance is all there is, then men might be able to find out everything there is, to find out and to know everything there is to know. If there is no infinity, if everything is finite, then finite creatures like ourselves might be able to get to the end of every problem and get to the end of all knowledge and be able to say, we know everything. But one of the reasons God has put eternity in the heart is to make you realize that there is an infinite. Notice it says here, so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. We might be able to look at a little bit of God's world, one of the little subjects in our little area of expertise, and say, we know it from beginning to end. But then you look at the libraries and the bookshops and the colleges and universities and you realize, I know 0.01%. And God brings events into our lives to humble us, to make us realize we can't control everything. We can't know everything. We can't predict everything. It says he does this so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. The men, the women, the young people that think they know better than God. It's like somebody standing facing a wall in the Grand Canyon and saying, I can see it all. All you can see is one little, maybe square foot of wall. Anyone looking at you would think, you're mad. You don't know the beginning and the end of it just by looking at this little part. This is what Solomon is saying. One of the effects of providence, one of the results of all these changes in our lives as we reflect on them, is to make us realize, left to ourselves, we can know nothing for sure. If it's all our own research and all our own reading, we'll never find out the work that God makes from the beginning to the end. And so it behoves us to be humble as we enter this new year, recognizing our limitations and knowledge and control, humility. But then, fourthly, there's duty. The person that looks at and just sees many human events and sees it all as pointless, what's his response going to be as he enters 09? It's going to be, oh, I can't be bothered with it anymore. There's no point me getting up, working hard, putting all this into my life and my family's life if it all ends in a big zero. I'm just going to give up. I'm going to take a year out or 2 years out. I'm going to try lots of different things. I'll try another woman, I'll try another job, I'll try another country, I'll try another this or that or the next thing. But the person who sees purpose and point in it all sees that I have a duty to do. This is what Solomon says in verse 12. I know that there's no good in them but for a man to rejoice and to do good in his life. Solomon's saying, and he's, this kind of refrain, it's like a chorus that comes up time and again in the book of Ecclesiastes. There's a lot of pessimism expressed, but time and again he comes back to this. God's given me work to do. God's given me life to live. God's given me things to enjoy. Therefore I recognize it's all from him and I go about my daily duty. And this is what Solomon's saying again here. There's a purpose and there's a point, therefore there's duty. God has put things in my path to do, a job to do, a family to look after, relationships to cultivate, service in the church to complete. And that's the best thing I can do. Get on with it, trusting in the Lord, looking to him to sustain me and make sense of everything. It's not for me to understand the beginning and the end, but just to go on with what God's given me to do. I'll never get all my questions answered. I'll never get all my puzzles solved. But one thing I know, here's my job, here's my responsibility, here are my relationships. Let me pour myself into them and serve God in them to the best of my ability. Duty. He says in verse 13 that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. And that transforms everything. All our work, our homes, our service. When God is in it, there's purpose in it, and there's point in it, and there's meaning in it. And there can be joy in it and happiness in it, even when some things are painful to do and experience. It is the gift of God. That transforms a plate of meat and potatoes and vegetables, doesn't it? That transforms the kitchen sink. That transforms the conveyor belt. That transforms all these files that I've got to file away. That transforms all the paperwork. That transforms all the oily machinery I've got to work in. That transforms that pile of books I've got to study. That transforms exams. That transforms everything. It is the gift of God. God is in it. God has given me this to do, and this is how and why I glorify Him. Duty. And then there is submission. Verse 14, I know that whatsoever God doeth, it shall be forever. Nothing can be put to it, nor anything taken from it. Here he's looking at providences that he would love to change. He would love to reverse. He would like this to be done in a different way or in a different time or to a different person. But he looks at it and he says, what God does, it will be forever. I can't change it. I can't reverse it. I can't transfer it. What God does is forever. I can't add to it. I can't take away from it. Here is submission. He's not fighting. He's not rebelling. These are words of submission. He's saying, I can't change my providence, but I can change my attitude to it by God's grace. I can't change God's plan and purpose, and there's no point in me trying, but I can change how I think about it, react to it, and respond. Submission. That's a good way to enter 09, isn't it? Especially if we're in a difficult providence that we cannot change, though we'd love to. To see it, that it's God doing it, that it's forever, that we can't add to it, and we can't take from it. Therefore, best way is just to humbly, gladly submit to his plan and purpose. And then, sixthly, there's reverence. God doeth it, at the end of verse 14, that men should fear before him. There's one impact of providence and all the events of life. It is that it should make us tremble before God. To make us see how frail we are, how vulnerable we are. How impossible it is for any of us to grab control of our lives and to take our own steering wheel and direct our life wherever we want it. We can't do it. We've surely come to realize that. And God brings event after event after event in our lives to make us see this. And eventually, instead of standing there trying to control, eventually hand the steering wheel over and say, let God be God. And let me fear. Let me tremble. Let me revere. Let me worship. Let me be in awe before Him. There's a well-known British Methodist preacher, William Sangster. He was told that he had progressive muscular atrophy and he would never be well again. He made four resolutions and he kept them to the end, and there were these. One, I will never complain. Two, I will keep the home bright. Three, I will count my blessings. And four, I will try to turn it to gain. That's submitting to providence, isn't it? But then finally, judgment. Verse 15, that which hath been is now, and that which is to be hath already been. Here he's going over this cycle again. He's reflecting, he's summarizing really, verses 2 to 8. And then he says, and God requireth that which is past. God will call me to account. There's a day of reckoning, a day of explanation, a day of examination ahead. Let's enter 09 with that word too on our lips, with all these words on our lips. Beautiful. Eternity. Humility. Duty. Submission. Fear. And judgment. That's the response of optimistic faith. That's how the believer looks at the past and translates it into a future attitude that pleases God and that will be good for that soul. Or maybe you're entering 09 with the exact opposites. That's a sad, sorrowful, worrying way, isn't it, to enter 09. To look out and say everything's a mess. To be focused just on time. To be proud and arrogant. To feel, ah, duty, who cares, I'll just follow my pleasure and passions. To be fighting God. To be fearless before Him. And to have no thought of the final day of reckoning. We all enter the new year in one of these attitudes. Pessimistic fatalism or optimistic faith. What is your attitude? Let it be optimistic faith. Far better way to live. So control the past that you control your attitudes and your outlook as you enter the future. Let us pray. Lord, as we head towards eternity, we know that for some of us, it will be as a sunrise with no sunset. And for others, it will be a sunset with no sunrise. Let thy providence lead us to salvation. Let the events of time point us to the divine purpose. In Jesus' name, amen.